Welcome back to the Immigration Guy podcast. Today, we're thrilled to have a distinguished guest, Alex Narasta. Alex is the Vice President for Economic and Social Policy Studies at the Cato Institute and a renowned author whose works have featured in major publications across the United States. He's also the co-author of the award-winning book, Wretched Refuse, The Political Economy of Immigration and Institutions. With his extensive knowledge in economic history and immigration studies, Alex is here to share his insight on the current state of immigration policy and its impact on the economy. Welcome, Alex.
Hey, thanks a bunch for having me.
Hey, y'all. This is The Immigration Guy with Kyle Farmer.
Can you kind of just tell us what's the Cato Institute?
Yeah, so Cato is a libertarian think tank in Washington, D.C. We were founded in 1977, and my colleagues and I work on a wide range of pretty much every public policy issue in the United States, but also many overseas and internationally. Our core principles are individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. And for most of my career, I have worked exclusively on immigration policy.
That's really cool. So you're in D.C.?
Yeah. I've been out here for quite a while now. I think I would call it home by now.
How long have you lived there?
So I actually moved out here for undergrad in 2002, and with the exception of a couple years for a graduate school and other school, I have been here. So about 20 years.
Oh, great. Great. That's awesome. Well, it's good to talk to you. Can you kind of tell us about your book? And I really would just kind of like to hear the thesis of your book, and maybe we can talk about that some.
Yeah. So, I've been studying immigration intensively for about 15 years working on that issue. And I continually found that most of the counterarguments against immigration, my position, which is to expand legal immigration quite a bit, that most of these counterarguments are pretty weak. And there's a large amount of evidence that says they're pretty weak. And these arguments are the standard ones, right? Like they lower wages, they take jobs, immigrants don't assimilate, they're really dangerous. Those types of arguments that are really common. But one argument that I did encounter that there was basically no research on when I started working on it is this idea that immigrants come from poor countries. They come from countries with bad institutions. And by bad institutions, what economists and economic historians mean is rules and laws that basically govern economic exchange. So things like property rights, contract rights, whether it's socially acceptable even for people of different, say, social classes to be able to deal together in business. And one of the dominant theories in economic history is that countries with better institutions that have more protection for private property rights, that have contract rights, are more prosperous because those institutions, to get pretty wonky for a second, they align the incentives well. It basically means that economic actors are incentivized to produce goods and services that other people want because they can keep most of the benefits. They can keep the profits from those activities. So everybody's incentivized to do really well. But when you take a look around the world, there are only a handful of really developed countries, and they are characterized by having pretty good institutions, and the United States is one of them. But most immigrants come from countries with usually not very good institutions, where the property rights, the insecurity, the contract rights are pretty poor, or if they're good on paper, they're poorly enforced. And the idea is whatever created the good property right regime in the United States could be undermined if a large number of people come from countries with bad institutions. And I found this argument made by skeptics of immigration to be the potentially most convincing, or to be the most convincing if it were true. If it turns out, because economic growth in the history of the world is extremely rare and it is extremely recent, and it is the reason why you and I don't live basically in small huts and die by the age of 30, like most of our ancestors did for almost the entirety of human civilization. So it's a precious and important thing that is worth defending and extending if possible. So if immigrants could undermine that in some way, then that would be a devastating counterargument. And I would have to change my opinion about what to do about immigration. So some colleagues and I and some co-authors across the country started investigating this topic in detail in 2014. I wrote some blog posts about it that turned into some academic papers, that turned into more academic papers, and we basically started this whole field of investigation of trying to see how immigration affects institutions. And that culminated in writing this book, which is the first book. Retro Refuse is the first book about how immigration affects institutions in the countries where immigrants go to.
That's really interesting. So what did you end up finding? You ended up finding that they, you know, that I do think that's interesting. And I also think I'll be interested to hear your thoughts on illegal immigration and what the implications are on assimilation to American values and through illegal immigration. But anyways, let's kind of hit that first. What is the, what'd you learn? Were you persuaded?
What we found was that immigrants do tend to have either no effect on institutions in the places where they settle, or if they do have an effect, the ones that we found was that it increased the quality of those economic institutions in the places where they settled. And we found this both like broadly across the world, taking a look at average institutions and the stock of the foreign-born population in these countries. But we also found it in some, quasi-natural experiments, as economists call them. And what these are is a situation where there's like a really large and sudden surge of immigration into a country that's huge, that is not caused by anything that country did. So the two situations we examine in detail, the first involved Israel and the second involved Jordan. Now, the first one was, you know, Israel has this policy of the law of return, where Jews around the world can go to Israel and very rapidly can naturalize and can settle there and live. And what we found was in the early 1990s, when the Soviet Union was crumbling, a large number of Soviet Jews went to Israel all of a sudden, basically increased Israel's population by 20% in a five-year period, which is gigantic. It would be like 65 million people moving to the U.S. in 5 years.
Yeah,
I mean, just like an incredible increase. And what we found was that Israel's economic institutions went from looking like other crappy Middle Eastern countries, pretty much, you know, with a lot of problems, a lot of inflation, poor property rights, a lot of socialism, and basically improved to look like an OECD country by the year 2000. And when you dig down into the details about what happened in Israel, what you found is a lot of these, Soviet immigrants who came from country with some of the worst economic institutions in the world to Israel, that they tended to vote for political parties that were more supportive of free markets. They tended to sort of basically upend the political system in Israel to an extent where they liberalized quite a bit, got inflation under control, opened up the economy to trade, and it had a positive impact on those institutions. The other situation was Jordan, which is a really weird one, because Jordan, prior to the mid to late 1980s, if you were a Palestinian, you got a Jordanian passport. And then the Jordanian government changed the law and said, nah, you don't get these passports anymore, but anybody who already holds them can come to Jordan at any time. And what happened was there were hundreds of thousands of Palestinians with the Jordanian passports living in Kuwait. And what happened in Kuwait, of course, in the 1990 was that Saddam Hussein invaded and all these Palestinians basically left. Within the course of a short period of time, they all went to Jordan because that was the only place they could go to because they had these passports, most of whom had never even been to Jordan. And it increased Jordan's population by about 10% in the course of a year. And these people could vote to the extent that voting mattered in Jordan at the time. And it was quasi-democratic. You know, there was some democracy in Jordan. Yeah. And what we found is that Jordan went from having, you know, normal, crappy Middle Eastern institutions to having economic institutions that look like the OECD country within about other OECD countries within about 10 years. And when you drill down into looking at why this happened, what you find is that Jordan liberalized because of all these migrants coming, in that the Jordanian elite basically realized we've got bad economic conditions in Jordan. These people come, they're all going to be unemployed. That's going to cause serious political problems. We've tried to do state-led development before with a bunch of big government industries trying to employ people. It didn't work. We just have to liberalize and open up the economy to trade. We need to get our monetary system under control. We need to deregulate. And they did that. And it was quite a big improvement in the quality of those institutions.
So have y'all ever studied the impacts of immigration from countries that have a large social safety net from their government to countries that don't? So I guess an example would be, let's say that you're moving from a country with socialized healthcare, but you're moving into the United States. You're immigrating into the United States. Well, what happens to the policies of the United States in that circumstance where they're moving from a country with a large social safety net to a country without one?
So we haven't been able to discern any effects from, say, like OECD, because other OECD countries, just about all of them have nationalized healthcare, like full nationalized healthcare. I mean, most healthcare spending in the U.S. is by the government, but it's not like a fully, universal system by any means. So we took a look at the OECD immigrants to the United States and saw how that was correlated with changes in economic freedom in the United States. And we found that was less positive than immigrants from poorer non-OECD countries to the United States. But it's not like that's not the most rigorous statistical analysis. Like, I don't want to bet my house on that one. Just because its statistics are difficult to try to discern what's going on. But what is interesting, taking like a really extreme example of like immigrants from communist countries or like extreme socialist countries like Venezuela, Cuba, China, Vietnam, things like that, we haven't been able to discern like an overall institutional impact in the United States because those immigrants are still a small portion of the United States. But there is a lot of qualitative and anecdotal evidence that suggests these people are some of the most solidly, sort of anti-government voters in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. But presumably that's also because their government had their hands in other things that were not advantageous to them. You know, like they put their hands in virtually every aspect of their life, whereas a lot of these other countries, it's like just healthier.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I don't want to come off as saying, Cuba is no different than France, right? I mean, that's obviously not true.
That's how I took it. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, and if you, if you had open borders between France and Cuba, I think probably 95% of Cubans would leave and go to France. Yeah. And they would be substantially better off. The world would be much freer. But I think the question you're asking is, like, let's say all French people move to the United States. What would happen to economic freedom in the United States? And we don't really have, good evidence of that kind of thing. But the important thing to think about is there's this, self-selection mechanism when it comes to immigration, right? Like the people who immigrate from a country, who leave, are not like a random sample of the people who live there, right? They're usually you know, more entrepreneurial. Just like the fact of moving, I think, is evidence of being entrepreneurial. They're more open to different experiences. They're not, you know, they're more cosmopolitan. And they're generally looking for more economic opportunity and for work opportunities. They're not really moving because they get, like, you know, marginally more food support.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Medicaid from the U.S. government.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's definitely true. The individuals, they have a higher risk tolerance. I guess that's kind of the nice thing about knowing what the floor feels like is, mm-hmm. you know, that the floor is not as bad here as it is elsewhere. And so you're coming here like, okay, well, I can only fall so far but it also gives me the latitude and kind of removes the fear barrier of going and starting a business, you know, open up a car dealership. Like I think that's a pretty common one. I couldn't agree with you more there. I've had this conversation with a number of libertarians and I've kind of got a wide range of responses. What is the libertarian position on illegal immigration?
So, I think the libertarian position is similar to that of illegal drugs, which is that illegal immigration exists because we have laws that make it very difficult to impossible for the vast majority of people who want to live here to do so legally. And as a result of making that illegal, you know, the result is a black market. And that black market contains numerous problems. You see chaos at the border right now, which is, you know, I think an extreme amount of chaos. You have a large population living in the shadows in the United States who are afraid to use the courts, who are sometimes, in some cases, afraid to use the police, who can be the victims of crime and are afraid to report that, and who are generally, like, less legally secure than they otherwise would be. So I think illegal immigration is a consequence of our really, really bad immigration laws that are restrictive. And the way to resolve that problem is to legalize the folks who are here unlawfully, you know, the ones who are not violent and property offenders, but the normal people who are not committing any other crimes. And to make it a lot easier in the future for people to come here legally so that they don't have to come here illegally. And as a result, we get control over the border. So sort of in the same way that the government killed the bootleggers in the early 20th century by ending prohibition. You know, there's always going to be some illegal immigration. But if we can shrink it so that those people are all like the bad people, we can actually get a much better handle on it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a tough situation because you do have to have strong borders, because if you are an adversary of the United States and you know that you can't immigrate here legally because you are, I don't know, let's say you're a terrorist, you're trying to get inside the United States. Well, it makes it awfully easy if you've got a weak border to come up through the southern border, or if you're a violent criminal or whatever it is. Now, to your point, that's not the vast majority of these people. They're generally law-abiding people, aside from the fact they're violating the law in the first place to get into the United States. I think I agree in part and I disagree in part. I don't think that I would legalize all the people that are here unlawfully. The reason is because I think that would further incentivize illegal immigration in the future. Whenever people say that they can't get in, even if you loosened up immigration laws. Well, let's say I can't get in the front door even with looser immigration laws. Well, I'm still going to come in illegally. And whenever I do, I'm going to be doing it with the expectation that I will get naturalization at some point in the future. And I think that it's obvious that that is a consequence of even proposing naturalization for people that are here unlawfully, because every time that we've seen it, there's been a surge of illegal immigration. And so I think it – it matters a lot where you would draw the line of like, okay, well, what are we keeping people out for? How are we letting them in? But I think that that's the one part that I would disagree with on in terms of how you would do it without promoting further illegal immigration.
Yeah, I mean, what I think is the most important part here is the expanding the legal immigration component. Mm-hmm. So if you put a gun to my head and said, hey, choose legalizing the current illegal immigrant population or increasing legal flows by, say, like a factor of three, I would absolutely choose increasing the legal flows. And that would decrease, you know, the future increase in illegal immigration, decrease those flows dramatically. I think that was the big mistake we made with prior amnesties, is that we did an amnesty. We did do large increases in enforcement in every previous amnesty that we've had, but we didn't increase the legal flow portion. It would be like in Prohibition, right? Like we let all the bootleggers out of prison. We hire a lot more Elliot Nesses to go around and try to round up bootleggers, but we don't make alcohol legal. Like the situation is just going to repeat itself. Now, and so I think in that situation, right, you create a legal system that is large, that is flexible, that responds to the market. You can shrink that future flow problem of illegal immigrants by upwards of 90%, maybe 95% or more. You can get a handle on the rest of it. And I think in that situation, you solve both of those problems.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a – yeah. What do you think about – in terms of how people would actually apply to get here. So like right now, I mean, you've got a few ways of getting in. You've got, if you're, let's say that you're a family member of someone here that could petition for you, you've got an employer sponsoring you. And then if you're fleeing some sort of persecution, what avenues would you propose making easier, or what would that look like?
So I think all those avenues should be expanded. And one way to do that would be to say, like, if you are eligible for a green card, then you have to wait for no more than like 3 to 5 years to get it, regardless of any numerical caps. That'd be one way to really shorten it. There aren't too many people who are going to be like, oh, man, I have to wait 3 years. I guess I'm going to go enter illegally and live in a black market for the rest of my life. Like, people are going to wait for that.
Right.
But the most important thing for getting control of the borders, and I do believe in border security. I do believe in having borders that are strong. But the way that you do that is by increasing illegal flows. But you need to do that for low and mid-skilled workers who are coming in. And that could be, you know, I prefer the option of permanent, you know, green cards for these folks. But, you know, temporary work visas are fantastic. And they should be opened up to many, many more occupations. There should be much less regulation on all of these. The workers themselves should be much more mobile and legally portable. That is, you know, they'd be able to change jobs really easily. And we should open it up for all types of occupations. Like, for instance, it should be as easy to come here to work in, you know, let's say like jobs that require like an associate's degree, which is, you know, somewhat skilled, but not like high skilled, right? Like mid skilled,
right?
As it is to come in to work on an H-1B in a nonprofit. So a little known fact about H-1Bs is if you're working in a nonprofit research institution, like a think tank, then there's no numerical cap. There are other regulations in place, like wage rules and some other things. But basically there's no numerical cap. So what I'd like is the rest of the U.S. economy to be as theoretically open to foreign-born workers as my current job is. Which would be quite open. Basically, there's no visa for like a mid-skilled worker, for instance. Like if you want to come in as a plumber, if you want to come in as a welder, somebody who has knowledge in working with machine tools, working on an oil rig. You know, there's no visa for these folks to come in lawfully.
Yeah. No, I think you're exactly right about that. I think it's just – it's really ridiculous that we have caps on these things because I'm going to ask you a little bit in a second about why you prefer green cards over temporary visas, because I would actually have those the other way around. Then I'll tell you. I'll also kind of. But I'll be curious to hear why, because you probably have more knowledge and statistics on it than I do. But anyways, I do think it's kind of ridiculous that we have these arbitrary caps, because they are arbitrary. And it just doesn't make much sense, even if you – which I don't believe that it depresses the wages either. I think it's just statistically untrue that that happens whenever you have immigrants move in. It is ridiculous to me, because it seems like this arbitrary constraint that we put on economic development and growth by just arbitrarily tightening the labor market. Like, why are we doing that? That makes no sense to me. But I'm guessing it was at one point a political bargaining tool to get some bill through.
Oh, totally. I mean, it's just like arbitrary numbers picked out of a hat in the political process. And when you go through to look at the congressional record and to see this, I mean, it really is like just insane how arbitrary it is. And then insane how the regulations sort of adjust it. So, for instance, there's like a cap of 140,000 skilled workers. And that's what it says in the statute. But the way that the government actually counts it is they count their spouses and minor children against that cap, too. So in reality, it's like 70,000 or so skilled workers a year. And that's totally arbitrary. I mean, it's a real example of like Soviet style central planning. Like, oh, we shall have no more than this, rather than letting the market guide these decisions, which we know the market does a better job in determining the quantity of steel that should be produced every year, how many barrels of oil should be pumped every year. But for some reason, like the number of workers who can come in, workers being like a very important factor of production, that should be controlled by Congress, regulators, and these people who think they know better than the, you know, millions of entrepreneurs and other people in the economy. It just doesn't make any sense.
It makes no sense. So why would you prefer green cards over temporary visas?
So I think you attract a slightly different type of person with the green card. First off, I think you attract a type of person who is more interested, of course, in permanently being in the United States. They are probably more entrepreneurial, more likely to start businesses. You're more likely to get somebody who is like one of those unicorns. Who will, and it's hard to identify who those people are ex ante, but they could just like start the next, you know, Fortune 500 company. And who are they? I don't know who they are. Or maybe their kids are going to be that way. So I worry about excluding a lot of these like really high achievers or potential high achievers as a result of that. Also, just the flexibility. No matter what temporary system you design, the flexibility of having a green card in the labor market is just going to be greater. The ability to like change jobs on a whim, to start a business on a whim, et cetera. Like theoretically, you could probably design a guest worker visa that's pretty close to that, but it's just going to be hard. And then furthermore, that opens up other things to them, like access to capital markets. Whereas if you're going to be in the U.S. for like, you know, 3 or 5 years max, and then you've got to go home to your home country, the scope for you starting a business or a job or anything like that is just going to be constrained also by your access to capital. And I do like the idea of allowing, people who feel this deep connection of made in the U.S. to be able to stay. Now, maybe that means you could have like a hybrid, right? You have like a massive guest worker visa program and you allow people who demonstrate some kind of attachment or interest or ability to easily transfer to a green card. Maybe that would be like a hybrid solution. Singapore kind of does this in some ways. Much of the current U.S. system, frankly, does this in some ways with like the H-1B to green card pipeline. But opening that up to lower and mid-skilled workers, I think would be a good thing to do. But in any case, you know, more guest worker visas would also be like a tremendous improvement. And I would take that deal in a second.
Yeah. So what do you say to the person that says, okay, but if we allow a whole bunch of people here permanently, so the nice thing about a temporary visa is that they're testing the labor market annually. So they know if there is an actual job shortage in that area. Whereas with green cards, you're not testing it annually. So what happens if you end up bringing in a whole bunch of immigrants, then the labor market softens, and you just have more people out of work?
Yeah, I mean, you could have that. I mean, what we saw even like historically in the early 20th century when the U.S. had basically open borders with Europe was a lot of back and forth movement. People who had lawful permanent residency, the equivalent of economy does poorly in the U.S., they go back home. You see that currently with a lot of Mexican Americans who have a green card and they retire at age 65. They're done working. Yeah, they go back home because it's cheaper to live in Mexico and to retire. So I think when people conceptualize immigration, they think it's like a one-time move and those people are here forever and they don't ever go. Meanwhile, in reality, the flow back and forth is tremendous. So I think it's much more of sort of a self-regulating labor market than people give it credit for. Like in the same sense that, you know, a lot of people could move to like a booming city, like up in North Dakota when there was booming under the shale oil boom back like a decade ago and 5-10 years ago. When that diminished, a lot of those people left. They moved to other places. And sometimes they moved back to where they were from. They moved to other places of opportunity. So I'm not so worried about that. If there's no opportunities, people aren't going to come. And if there's fewer opportunities, fewer will come and some will leave.
Yeah. What about – so I guess what are the differentiators there between the example in North Dakota and let's say that they moved from West Virginia? Well, it's kind of like where's the floor? Because give me the worst circumstances in the United States over – average experiences in Nicaragua any day. And so how would you see that self-regulation without dragging the United States down to the floor of whatever the other country is?
So the other thing to think about is, let's say you're a Mexican immigrant in the U.S. You came during good times. You saved up $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000. With the intent of going home eventually, maybe to buy a house or to start a business. And then all of a sudden there's a recession in the U.S., you lose your job, you can't find a new one. A lot of those folks just leave early with their money because they can, even the economy is not great in Mexico, they can at least live like a lot longer at a much higher standard of living on that amount of money in Mexico than they could in the United States. So I think that's one avenue in which that happens. There is some evidence about things like this that occur. There's some debate amongst sociologists and economists about like when return migrants decide to go home. Like, are they basically losers who couldn't make it? Are they people who had like a goal of like saved money to have before they went back home? Once they meet that goal, they just leave. Or is it people who are like, I'm going to work as long as I can, save as much as I can, and when I can't work anymore, I'm going to go home with this pot of money, like whatever that pot of money is. And it seems to be like a mix of all three.
I think that's right. I think it is a mix of all three. I think it's right.
And I think, we see that, among Americans, there's a long history of like boom towns in the United States, like North Dakota being a recent example for this. Yeah. But also like the Old West is dotted with these old towns that were, there was a gold mine or the railroad had a stop through there or whatever. And then it dries up and they leave and find new opportunities. But also the good thing about the United States is even when the economy nationally ain't doing so well, there's usually places that are doing a lot better than others. Yeah. And by having immigrants here who are a lot more mobile inside of the United States than native-born Americans, they're not as, tied down to, being close to their folks because their folks are far away no matter what. They move to places where the economy is growing, and it tends to help the economy grow there a little faster, both in terms of, like, more workers who can produce more goods and services, but also more consumers in those areas that increase demand.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's interesting. I imagine that there's also some difference between the originating countries, because like Mexico is not nearly as bad off as a country like Nicaragua. Nicaragua is the poorest country in our hemisphere. I mean, it's a very, very tough place to live.
And other than Haiti, I think. I think Haiti's worse.
Yeah. I think you're right.
And maybe Venezuela now. I'm not sure.
Really? Is that Nicaragua? Ooh, yeah. Either way, maybe. I don't want to live in any of them.
Bad.
So I would imagine that there would be some difference between originating countries. There just has to be. I mean, it just logically makes more sense. But then to your point, maybe those are the people that are more willing to be mobile, and as opposed to going back to their home country, well, they're going to whichever city or state where it's booming, and they're supporting that economy more.
That's right. So I think, like, in some cases, you're right. Like, I don't think, like, anybody's going to return to Haiti. I don't think anybody's going to return to Cuba. I don't think anybody's going to go back to, you know, if there are any immigrants in the U.S. or North Korea, there's probably like a handful of refugees, right? None of them are going to go back to North Korea, right? Like, there definitely is this, like, or Afghanistan. Like, there is this floor. You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, those are the exceptions, I think, rather than the rule.
Yeah, I think that's true. I don't know if that would change, though, if you just had complete fluidity within the border, though.
That's a good point. I think one of the things to also realize is that the people who mostly move in the world, who are migrants, are not the poorest people.
That's true.
The poorest people are basically indigent. They don't have the money to move. You know, they're subsistence farmers. They have an income of like $1,000 to $3,000 per year, and they can't take the time off or have the resources to be able to move. Research by Michael Clemens, who's at George Mason University now, basically finds like emigration with an E, people leaving a country, basically peaks between about $8,500 and $10,000 per year in GDP for people in that country is when it peaks. Because that's where they have enough money to be able to move, probably enough connections or ability to learn about the United States so that they know where they're going. And where they probably have enough skills where if they were to come to the U.S., their income could increase by quite a lot. Whereas, you know, their economies are probably growing a good amount, but it's going to take like 100 years or 50 years to get up to where the U.S. is. So they can get that like 50-year bump right away by coming here. Those are the people who tend to move.
That's really interesting. That's very interesting. So where do you see our immigration policies moving as a country, or do you see them not moving?
Well, I can tell you where I think they need to move, but the debate is very fraught over this. You know, I do think they need to open up, and they need to open up for basically all workers at all skill levels, families, entrepreneurs, refugees, asylum seekers. And I think the main economic reason why is that U.S. population growth is basically all coming from immigration now because the fertility rate in the U.S. is so low.
Yep, that's another issue.
Yeah, it's huge. It's a huge issue. And in order to have an economy that grows, we do need more workers. We need more entrepreneurs. We need more people who are here at every skill level contributing. We need to do that. But there is a huge ideological divide between the two major parties in the United States on this. Like, people like to joke about like the Uniparty and all this. And like, you will not think that if you look at the immigration issue. Like, there is not a Uniparty.
No, there's not. Immigration is kind of a crazy – it is a crazy issue because – there's not a real political ally as it relates to good immigration policy. And there's kind of like not that many issues that you can think of where you're like, I generally align with this policy, this political position from this party on this particular issue. Like, most things you can point to like that. Immigration, I don't think you can actually do that.
It's definitely mixed. Like, for instance, like, Democrats are really bad on like temporary work visas, for instance.
Yep.
Like, terrible. That the regulations they want to put on those are atrocious. They're generally pretty good though on green cards, so I'll give them that.
Yeah.
And they generally do want to expand those, and sometimes by quite a bit. And the Biden administration, I give them credit for the parole programs for the, you know, Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, Venezuela, and I give Congress credit for the Ukrainian one as well. So I give those guys a lot of credit. But, you know, the last major Republican bill introduced when there was a chance of it becoming law on immigration was the RAISE Act. during the Trump administration, which would have cut the number of green cards in half and killed the H-1B visa. So it's like both, neither parties are good, but I do think on this issue, the Republican Party is like substantially worse at this stage. Anything could change because that party just seems to be like, you know, whatever Donald Trump wants at the moment. And that seems like it could change at any moment. And it's ideologically fluid. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
They don't know the ideological pronouns they've settled on yet.
Yeah. I think that's right there.
It's weird.
It is weird. It is weird. And they both are pretty bad. Generally speaking, for the type of work that we do, Democratic administrations are significantly worse on our types of immigration that we deal with a lot. They just generally are. Because we do a lot of temporary visas. So it's like they pound temporary visas, whereas the Republicans are generally better for that. If you were giving me a percent chance, what percent chance do you think there's substantial immigration reform within the next 5 years?
Like through Congress, a bill through Congress?
Yep.
I'd say the chances of a bill are probably about 10%, maybe less.
I think you're right. I think it's a proverbial snowball in hell's chance that they're going to pass any kind of substantial immigration reform in the next 5 years. Because it's just like there's no way to reconcile their political agendas in an immigration bill.
I think that's right. And I think all the action is going to be on actions by the president and administrative agencies in this regard. And I think this is a general problem with the American system of government at the moment, is that the role of Congress is diminishing. Congress is not dead, but it is very sick. It is very sick. And the presidency, unfortunately, is a very robust and vigorous institution. So I think the chances, though, of like a really big series of administrative actions that vastly expand lawful migration, not like permanent immigration, because that's in Congress's purview, but say the number of people who can live and work lawfully in the United States through an administrative action, I think is very high.
Yeah.
Very high. Something like the CVNH program, but for another dozen countries in the Western Hemisphere. With vastly higher caps, if any numerical caps, I could see that as a possibility, and that would be a game changer.
Yeah. I think one thing that's clear is there's a world out there of people that want to work here, and we've got employers here that are desperate for those people, and it just makes no sense to throw up these arbitrary barriers of keeping them from entering.
That's right. The sad thing, so my background's in economics. I'm trained in economics. I live and breathe and eat economics and sleep economics. My wife is pretty sick of me talking about economics. But I do think most of the debate and concern about immigration is not about economics.
What do you think it's about?
I think it's about perceptions of chaos. I think people see chaos, which exists. You can't turn on the TV and not see it along the border. And when people see chaos, their reaction is to turn against that thing that's causing the chaos. And, you know, they're not too discerning about it. They're against, much more opposed to immigration than they otherwise would be, because of this chaos along the border. You know, I think there are other people, you know, some number of people who are concerned because these people come from different cultures and that's really bad for culture. There are some people who are really concerned about the politics. You know, they think these people are all going to vote for one party or the other. I think there are a handful of people, not too many, but a handful of people who just really don't like foreigners for whatever reason. They don't want him here. You know, a small number of people who are like, oh, this is really bad for the environment because these people are going to be richer and consume more here. But really, the big thing is just this perception of chaos. If we had illegal immigrant numbers that were like 25,000 a year rather than, you know, 2 million apprehensions or so, this debate would be vastly different. It would be like the debate they have in Canada where they just massively increase their illegal immigration numbers, right? It'd be a debate about, well, do we want more people working here or not? Yeah, workers are awesome. And that's just so different from the chaos and the crime and the terrorism and the conspiracy theories. And then there's like the horrible things that you see that are actually going on along the border and the disorder and the chaos.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. So tell us, what's the best way for our listeners to connect with you?
So one way is to go on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Alex Narasta. That's at AlexNowRasteh on Twitter, or, you know, X, I guess is what it's called now.
It's a letter.
Yeah, it's hilarious. The letter X, not EX, just X. And then,
yes, exactly.
The other way is on our Cato website. That's cato.org. And then I also have a Substack that's just my name, Alex Narasta Substack, where I publish pieces on immigration. So you follow me on any of those, and you can see my writing and comments on this issue.
And what about your book?
Yes, sorry. How could I not? My publisher is going to be pissed.
I got your publisher's back. I just got the note from him.
I really appreciate that. You just saved me like them showing up at my house in the middle of the night to yell at me. My book, Wretched Refuse, it's available at on Amazon, some fine bookstores, I guess, probably, but you can get a Kindle copy that's pretty affordable. There's also a paperback, and if you're really feeling rich, there's a hardcover, but it's an academic publication, so the hardcovers are kind of pricey, so I recommend not doing that. But yeah, on Amazon.com, Wretched Refuse.
Your publisher just messaged me again and said they actually do recommend the hardback. Yeah. So we're, okay. I'm blocking your publisher now, though, because now they're abusing it.
Yeah, you can't see, but slightly out of frame here, my publisher is holding a firearm at me.
And you're in D.C., so I know that's not lawfully owned.
Probably not.
Cool. Well, we appreciate it, Alex. It was good to meet you and good to talk to you. We appreciate all the information you gave us.
Hey, thanks a bunch. This was a blast.
Yeah, it was great. We'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you all for listening to the Immigration Guy podcast. We really appreciate it. You can find us on our website. Go to www.farmerlawpc.com. You can find me on LinkedIn and Twitter. Just search at Kyle Farmer FLPC. You can find our law firm on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. All you have to do is search for at Farmer Law PC. Go ahead and subscribe to download all the episodes of our podcast. You can download them and listen to them whenever and wherever you want. We'll be releasing new episodes every Wednesday on Spotify, Apple Music, Stitcher, which is apparently a real thing, Amazon Music, Google, and wherever else you get your podcasts. This is not legal advice, so any information that you get from this podcast should not be taken as such. If you are looking for legal advice, you should consult with a competent attorney for advice regarding your individual situation. If you want to schedule a consultation, just go ahead and use the link in the description of this episode. Thank you.